It's Labor Day, and we have a special show for you. Overlooked No More, How Asian Texans Shape the State, right here on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Joy Diaz. Today, how the Asian American community has changed from its origins back in the late 1800s to today, and the Persian Chinese, a story of Chinese immigration through Mexico. We will travel to the border where a vibrant Filipino community settled. And is it time to reevaluate the holidays we celebrate in Texas? Plus, K-pop and activism, jobs and healthcare during COVID. This is the Texas Standard. From the Gulf Coast to the Piney Woods, to the deserts of the West, and the Rio Grande Valley to the South, this is Texas, our home, sweet home. It's Monday, September 7th, Labor Day, and I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown with a special edition of the Texas Standard. Thank you for tuning in. As the 2020 census comes to a close, our show today is dedicated to one of the state's fastest growing populations, Asian Texans. But before we look at the rise, a little history and perspective. When the 1870 census first documented ethnic populations here, they counted only the number of Chinese in the U.S. Today, the term Asian American is a banner that includes more than 20 ethnicities. Some are recent immigrants. Others have been in Texas for generations. They worship in many ways, or not at all. They are doctors and teachers and students and monks and drivers. They're young, they're old, each with a unique story. This is by no means a comprehensive storytelling project, and it is not the last word. It is simply a conversation starter. With that, let's start the conversation. Let me introduce you to two guests who will be joining me today. Christine Chen is Executive Director of APIA Vote, that's Asian and Pacific Islander American Vote, based in Washington, D.C. And Lila Valencia is Senior Demographer at the Texas Demographic Center at UT San Antonio. Ladies, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation.
First, I want to talk about the rapid growth of the Asian American community. Lila, do you want to start?
Absolutely. So the Asian population in Texas makes up about 5% of the population. And that sounds like a small number, but that's about 1.5 million people. They are absolutely the fastest growing race ethnic group in the state. And they started off in 2010 at about 945,000. Already in 2019, there are 1.5 million Asians in the state of Texas, and our projections out of the Texas Demographic Center indicate that there could be close to 6 million Asians in Texas by 2050. In Texas, what we find is that most of the Asian community that live in the state of Texas are mostly Asian Indian or from Vietnam, China, with the exception of Taiwan, and then Filipino, Korean, and Pakistani. Those make up the larger shares of the Asian population in the state of Texas.
And when we use that name, Asian Americans, we sometimes overlook not just the diversity of where either their ancestors came from, but also diversity in faith, diversity in age groups, diversity in political beliefs. And this is where I would love to introduce Christine. Christine, when we are talking about the Asian American community, can we please start talking about political power, especially during this season when we have seen so many Asian American candidates?
It's been amazing to first start off with the presidential primaries where we had three individuals, Kamala Harris, Andrew Yang, as well as Tulsi Gabbard, all run
for the Democratic, yes,
on the Democratic side. Also at the same time, we're seeing a growth of Asian American candidates running for Congress, mm-hmm, as well as up and down the ticket. We've seen that trend the last decade. And we know that when additional Asian American and Pacific Islander candidates run for office, then they engage their own family and friends, which include the Asian American community. And then as a result, we have increased voter participation and also organizing efforts from these communities.
And again, one thing that we need to make clear is that when we talk about a quote unquote minority group, we're not talking about a de facto Democratic group.
Correct. So for API Vote, we conduct with our partners a survey of Asian American voters every 2 years. And we have seen the trend where in the early 90s to 2000, Asian American voters were leaning more heavily with the Republican Party. Mm. But then starting after 2000, we saw a shift where we're seeing a lot more Asian American candidates run as Democratic on the Democratic ticket. At the same time, there's a shift in terms of their attitudes on different issues. So even though the communities may be culturally diverse in terms of how they land and view and support different issues, they're actually quite similar. Mm. They may be point differences between like Vietnamese Americans and Filipino Americans who are a little bit more conservative to Indian Americans and Japanese Americans who are going to be a lot more progressive. But at the same time, 32% mm-hmm. say that they are independent, so they don't like to be considered a Democrat or a Republican. Most recently, in our 2020 preliminary poll, Joe Biden has about 54% of those that polled, and then 29% said they will support President Trump. For Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, what we found is that that category really is an American construct, mm-hmm. because the reality is that we really do represent over 50 different communities, many times from different countries around the world. And so when they immigrate here to the United States, they themselves are also learning what does that mean to be an Asian American and Pacific Islander.
Correct.
So in the beginning years, you know, it was seen as mostly being East Asian. Now I think there's a large realization, especially with the growth of Indian Americans, that they're also part of the Asian American and Pacific Islander category. The same thing with Filipino Americans. Many times they're being mixed up with Latinos. And in reality, they are also part of this AAPI construct.
Why is the community growing now? Why Texas?
Well, Texas has been leading in terms of economic indicators for quite some time. You know, even during the Great Recession, the recession was not as severe in the state of Texas, and we were able to come out of it a lot faster. And a lot of migration, whether it's migration from other countries or migration from other states, is largely driven by economic forces. And so we know that people of all sorts of backgrounds, including Asian Americans, are attracted to the state of Texas for reasons like quality of life, for reasons of cost of living and education. And we have some real strong areas of the state where the Asian population already has built communities there. Mm-hmm. And so they are attracted to the places where they already have family members who are living in those parts of the state. And what's interesting is that the very parts of the state that are growing the fastest, that are seeing the largest numbers grow, are also the same parts of the state where the Asian American population tends to live and tends to move to.
Is it more of an urban growth?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, a lot of the faster growth in the state of Texas is in the suburban ring counties of the major urban core counties. But what we're finding is that when international immigrants, whether they're moving from another country or another state, when they move to the state of Texas, they typically move to those urban core counties. And so, for instance, in Dallas and Harris County, we actually have negative net migration, which means that more people move out of those counties than move into them, with the exception of international migrants. Huh? And so, for instance, they are helping to boost the growth of those very large metropolitan cities and then helping to further diversify those already diverse areas of the state.
Christine, what is the turnout when it comes to elections in the Asian American community?
For the Asian American electorate, our voter registration rate is nearly half. But when we once they register, our turnout rate is quite comparable to the Latino community. Mm. So once again, what we really stress and focus on is that we want the candidates and the political parties to really engage and discuss the issues and the platforms that they represent with this base of voters and to develop a long-term relationship. What we found is that when they develop a long-term relationship with this new base of voters, they're more likely to continue to turn out to vote. But, you know, I think heading into 2020, I came into the cycle very optimistic in terms of the engagement that we were going to find from the Asian American electorate. The reason for that is because in 2018, we saw even young Asian voters who are typically had the lowest voter participation rate, they tripled their participation. In the past, we thought that we would have to focus a lot more about motivating individuals on why it's important to vote. But I think the last 6 months with the experiences of the Asian American Pacific Islander community in terms of what they face with COVID-19, in terms of facing increased anti-Asian sentiment and hate crimes being presented to them, and then also in terms of their work in allyship with communities of color and the Black Lives Matter movement, I believe this particular new electorate understands and connect the dots that decisions being made by your elected officials are impacting your lives every day.
Lila, is there anything that I have not asked you that you would like to add?
I think what I would add is that that's the beauty of the decennial census, is that it is the opportunity for people to be able to identify for themselves which one of those boxes makes them, you know, think this is where I belong, or to let them know there is no box that represents me. And the only way to really do that is by self-responding to the 2020 census. And I think it's a great opportunity to be able to say, this is where I fit. This is how I identify myself.
We've been speaking with Lila Valencia, senior demographer at the Texas Demographic Center, and with Christine Chen, the executive director of APIA Vote, about the Asian American community in Texas, its political power, and its role in the 2020 census. Christine Chen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Lila Valencia, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard, Overlooked No More, How Asian Texans Shape the State. We'll be right back. I'm Joy Diaz with a special edition of the Texas Standard, Overlooked No More, How Asian Texans Shape the State. Like a lot of stories about modern Texas, the story about how many of the first Chinese settle in the Lone Star State begins with the railroad. It's 1881 and Chinese railroad workers come to El Paso to build the first rail tracks that will connect Texas to California. Few clues tell us they were here back then. But these early Chinese immigrants to Texas came to build the railroad, not to build a community. That story of community started decades later. It's a story that can be told through the family of Dr. Mitchell Wong in Austin. When the 81-year-old rancher and ophthalmologist opens the gates to his Central Texas home, he's wearing a button-down shirt that depicts the American flag, white slacks, and ostrich cowboy boots.
You know, boots, you don't have to tie them or untie them. You just slip them on.
Dr. Wong loves languages.
¿Cómo está usted?
His first basic words of Spanish he learned from his grandparents.
My grandfather came to Mexico, and he was a baker.
The Wongs' journey to Texas is wrapped in the global story of the time, 1917. Julian Lim teaches history at Arizona State University, Tempe. She studies multiracial migrations along the U.S. and Mexico borders. Lim says to understand the routes first taken by Asians to Texas, 1917 is a pivotal year. The world's economy was ailing, there was a pandemic, it was 40 years after the U.S. had passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which restricted Asian immigration.
The other thing is, of course, by 1910, there's the Mexican Revolution, but also World War I. And so in lots of different ways, immigration to the U.S. gets really disrupted. And it becomes harder to cross these waters, right?
As a result, some Chinese immigrants came through Canada. Others opted for Mexico. But relations with Mexico were also disrupted when Mexican revolutionary Pancho Villa attacked the United States. At the time, many Chinese immigrants were living in Mexico. Dr. Wong's grandparents were among them. Professor Lim picks up the story.
And, you know, it's a huge deal. And the U.S. sends the U.S. Army.
5,000 men and even planes led by Army General John Pershing are sent into Mexico to bring back Pancho Villa, dead or alive.
And they're very unfamiliar with the region and with the topography and totally lost and can't find Pancho Villa. But what they end up doing is settling in these American Mormon communities that had settled in northern Mexico.
At the same time, Mexicans develop strong nationalistic feelings, an attitude of Mexico is for Mexicans, if you will, and that attitude pushed people of Chinese heritage out. Hundreds of Chinese people find their way to General Pershing's soldiers. So, when Pershing returns to the U.S. in 1917 after the nation lost interest in the pursuit of Villa, he brings with him 3,000 refugees. About 500 of them were Chinese.
And they're called the Pershing Chinese refugees.
Most were men, but Dr. Wong's grandfather and grandmother were among them.
My grandparents was one of the first, if not the first, Asian family to settle in Texas. So they were one of the original families that started having children in this country.
Dr. Wong is a second-generation Texan. His kids are third. His grandbabies are fourth. Their identities are no longer hyphenated. They're simply Texans.
That's what makes Texas unique. We are a forward-looking state. We appreciate our past, but we are a forward-looking state.
Now we will hear about the Filipino community. Houston is like Texas's Ellis Island, the most diverse city we have. That makes it attractive to many immigrant groups who have settled there over the past decades. But as Texas Standard's Kristen Cabrera reports, many in the Filipino community feel at home along the border.
When Neil Patrick Surio sat down in the cafeteria of his first U.S. high school, he was a little confused.
And I was like, why is everyone, like, so brown? And then a couple of people sat next to me, and then they started speaking in Spanish. I'm like, what the hell is going on? Like, I thought I was in the U.S.
This was 2009. At age 14, Surio moved with his family from the Philippines, and this, his first American high school, was in McAllen, Texas, along the South Texas border in the Rio Grande Valley.
It was kind of weird because, again, like, I kind of had this, like, idea of, like, the United States being, you know, like, majority Anglo.
The RGV is about 92% Hispanic, a fact that, to be fair to Surio, is not something that's necessarily translated outside of the Valley. Surio came to McAllen because it's where his new stepfather had a children's physical therapy clinic. After that initial culture shock, he began to see the many similarities between Filipino and Hispanic cultures.
But, like, maybe because of my background in history, I see these patterns of, like, oh, look, I could literally transplant the experience, like, the lived experiences I had in the Philippines back over here to the Valley, and it still somewhat makes sense to me as, like, a Filipino immigrant.
Common threads include language, community, Catholicism, names. Once Surio grew up, he started to connect another dot, Spanish colonization.
When I moved to Central Texas, that's when I started forming this opinion that, like, the Valley is a colonized space, just like how the Philippines is still a colonized space.
Latin America and the Philippines were both colonized by Spain, the Philippines for more than 300 years. Traces of Spanish influence are ingrained within both cultures.
I go back to like the colonial aspect of it. Yeah, like it's there, it's present. Like it's so culturally and economically distinct from the rest of Texas that I started thinking, well, something's going on here.
It's estimated that the total Asian population in the valley is around 11,500 people, and that number encompasses many ethnicities within this group. But the Filipino community represents nearly half of that population. But it wasn't always.
There were like 65 families total, including the outskirts like Rihondo, West Laco.
That's Nila Whip. She got her nursing degree in the Philippines and then migrated to the U.S. in 1968. She came to the Valley in 87 after her husband opened a chiropractic clinic.
It's like being in a small community, and we were a small community. The Mexican people, the Texans, are very friendly people.
There's also the Catholic faith. Whip shares a 3-foot-tall statue of La Virgen Fatima with her Catholic community. Before the pandemic, they'd pass it along house to house and gather to pray the rosary and, of course, eat.
We don't need to find an excuse to get together because the Virgin Mary statue has kept us together.
Many, like Whip, came to the U.S. because of a nursing shortage. Pat Lindsay Catalia Buscano in Houston is the Texas chapter president of the Filipino-American National Historical Society. She says the Immigration and Nationalities Act of 1965, plus exchange programs, allowed many in the Philippines to see a better life here.
And many of the nurses and the medical professionals in the Philippines were purposely and intentionally recruited to come here during that time frame.
In the Valley, the cultural contributions of the Filipino community are beginning to be recognized. The city of Edinburgh hosts an annual Filipino festival. Though this year's was sidelined by COVID-19, the city hopes to celebrate with everyone in the Valley next year. Something like a family celebration, as Surio sees it.
All these cultures from Mexico all the way down to Argentina was basically like long-lost cousins.
For the Texas Standard, I'm Kristen Cabrera.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
We continue with our special edition of the Texas Standard in just a moment.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The two candidates running for an open seat on the Texas Railroad Commission are offering contrasting visions of the agency's future in regulating the state's oil and gas industry. Democrat Krista Castaneda, an industry attorney and engineer, says the commission needs to curb natural gas flaring.
So why don't we turn that natural gas into generated electricity right there at the wellhead? It's one of the most expensive electricity markets in the nation out there in the Permian.
But Republican Jim Wright, an oilfield services business owner, disagrees.
And while the Railroad Commission can permit for the flaring of the natural gas, the regulation of the emission really belongs to the TCEQ.
Wright and Castaneda spoke on a panel presented by the Texas Tribune this morning. The Travis County Sheriff's Office says there's no evidence of foul play after 5 boats sank Saturday during a boat parade in the Austin area in support of President Trump. The Sheriff's Office received 15 distress calls from boaters on Lake Travis saying their boats were taking on water and capsizing. 3 of the boats were towed while 2 are still submerged. No injuries were reported. In a press release Sunday, TCSO said it believes the vessel sank due to big waves generated by the large number of boats. Houston Texans quarterback Deshaun Watson is now one of the highest-paid players in NFL history after signing a 4-year contract extension with the team worth more than $160 million over the weekend. Watson said he was at a loss for words during a news conference Saturday.
It's just, you know, an amazing moment for me to be able to extend my career in a location, in a place, in a home. I would say that my family love, that I love.
Watson's deal is second only to that of Kansas City Chiefs quarterback and Texas native Patrick Mahomes, who signed a $450 million 10-year contract extension in July. And former Democratic presidential candidate Julian Castro is launching a podcast Thursday. Castro, who previously served as the U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and the mayor of San Antonio, is calling it Our America. He previewed the podcast in a trailer.
It's an honest look at how drastically the American experience shifts from one person to the next. It's about the countless Americans who don't have time to dream because they're too burned out just trying to survive, facing poverty, hunger, and often discrimination.
Other Texas politicians with podcasts include U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from UT Austin's Value Institute for Health and Care, now enrolling for Financial Acumen, a value-based introduction, a four-week online executive education course designed for healthcare professionals. More at utvalueinstitute.org.
You're listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. It may seem to some like K-pop blew up overnight, but the U.S. craze for the South Korean music genre has been years in the making. To the point that K-pop is no longer just associated with music. Little by little, K-pop is also becoming synonymous with activism. Professor Cedar Bosegi is not surprised at all. Imagine, her Twitter handle is the K-pop prof. She's visiting assistant professor in East Asian languages and cultures at Indiana University Bloomington. Cedar Bo, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Why, thank you, Joy.
I wanted to ask you, some people may not be familiar with Korean popular music. Can you give us a primer on the rise of it in the U.S.?
Korean popular music has been trying to break into the American market for many years. But what's taken off has actually been the music that is in Korean, that is not made with the Western audience in mind, just the regular K-pop that people have been enjoying across especially East Asia for the last 20 years.
Yeah, because BTS, one of the most famous bands, a band that a lot of critics have called the new Beatles or the Beatles of this generation, is more of a purist, right? I mean, they do sing some songs in English, but a lot of it is in Korean.
Yes, their brand new release, Dynamite, is in English. But primarily, they have stayed with Korean as the language of their music. And they've actually said, we're a Korean group, and so we make music in Korean. And I actually love that.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the activism part, the advocacy part, because it's not unusual for musicians and even for some music genres to be considered political or to embrace advocacy. But what are the connections or the themes that K-pop music has in this respect?
Well, in fact, K-pop music is not very political, but K-pop artists, these idols, are supposed to demonstrate how to live in the world in, you know, a good way. And part of that has been a spirit of giving back to society. Mm-hmm. So it's not exactly political activism as much as it's understanding that we are all part of this community and we can give back to our community.
In Texas, the Asian American population is the fastest growing. And for some people, it's sort of a surprise to see how K-pop is transcending
language and nationality and all sorts of things that in the past have been considered barriers. What is it like for you to see this merging of cultures?
It is absolutely amazing to see the interest in the undergraduate population in learning about Korea. So all of this popular culture is actually prompting people to go beyond this somewhat parochial interest in just American culture, or, you know, perhaps being interested in Europe. When I was in high school, if you were going to go on exchange, people wanted to go to France or Italy or some country like that. Right now, there are American students who are going on high school exchange to Korea. And to me, that's just amazing.
Professor Cedar Bosaji is a visiting assistant professor in East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University Bloomington. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Have a wonderful day.
This is a special edition of the Texas Standard. Overlook No More, How Asian Texans Shape the State. We're coming up on 39 minutes past the hour. Don't go anywhere. There's a whole lot more ahead.
My name is Simranjeet Singh. I'm a writer, professor, and activist. I'm based in New York City, born and raised in San Antonio, Texas. So our family was the only family in all of South Texas with beards and turbans as part of our religious tradition. And so it put us in this strange sort of situation where we always felt like we had to explain who we were and even justify our existence. I also remember going to bookstores and wishing that there were books with characters who looked like us. And it would never happen. I would look every time and I would walk away disappointed. And I remember asking someone once if there were any books with Sikh characters. And the response I got was that it's not relatable. And so when my daughter was born 30 years later, I went back to those same bookshelves and looked for those books, and they still didn't exist. And so that's when I decided to start writing.
This is called Fojia Singh Keeps Going, the true story of the oldest person to ever run a marathon. It was a sweltering summer. Little Fojia Singh.
Fojia Singh is the oldest person to run a marathon, and in his 90s, he was shattering running records and getting all sorts of international attention. And it was when he crossed the finish line at the age of 100 and set the world record as the oldest person to run 26.2 miles. That was the day that I started running.
But Fojia did not listen, and Fojia did not stop. Instead,
the Sikh community's reaction has been so touching, because this is the first children's book from a major publisher to center on a Sikh story. There's this illustration in the book where a young Fojia Singh is braiding his daughter's hair. And when my daughter, she was 3 at the time, when she first saw that illustration, she squealed with delight. And she said, "Oh, that's you and me every morning." And that to me, like, my heart just melted in that moment. To me, it was like, that was the dream. That means the world to me. I'm Simranjeet Singh, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
You're listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard, Overlooked No More, How Asian Texans Shape the State. I'm Joy Diaz. Part of the immigrant experience involves redefining identity. Which parts of the homeland will one bring to this new home? What will stay behind? And how do those things evolve over generations? As the Texas Standard's Laura Rice reports, that includes things like language, food, and even holidays.
In India and other parts of South Asia, public life is set in part around the Hindu calendar. One of the most important holidays is Diwali. It's a five-day festival, but the third day is largely the most important.
There's a story about Lord Rama, who is one of our most prominent deities, and he defeats his enemy, the wicked Ravana, who actually kidnaps Lord Rama's wife. And so the day he returns home to his kingdom after that victory, that's what's celebrated as Diwali.
Brahmachari Hadi grew up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
So as a child, I'd hear this story again and again, loved hearing it. And, you know, mom would make sweets and really good food, and we'd get together as a community.
In India, no one is going to have to go to school or work on Diwali, even when it falls in the middle of the week. But in the U.S., public life is set primarily around Christian holidays, though there's precedent for accommodation being made for other religious holidays. Less than 1% of Americans are Hindu, so often those who celebrate Diwali have to make some choices.
We'd still do business as usual, school and work, and then we'd celebrate on the nearest weekend.
With us, that has almost kind of like become a tradition, that you celebrate it, you know, when you can.
Aarti Palodia came to Texas for college and stayed. She's a lecturer at UT Austin.
And I usually teach courses on Asian American history, culture, as well as migration.
She says Indian Americans first made their way to Texas more than 100 years ago, primarily to work in agriculture or on railroads. Now, many have made their way to Texas to work in the oil and gas industry around Houston and in information technology around DFW. That's where Monish Sethi lives.
My main profession is in IT. I'm on my second startup.
And for the last couple of years, he's been on the Coppell ISD school board. He's the first Indian American school board member in Coppell, even though almost 50% of students in the district are Asian.
Representation is extremely important. As soon as I joined, I started getting emails from Indian parents, which they didn't feel comfortable sharing before.
One issue a large number of Indian Americans in the district face is negotiating school responsibilities with Diwali. Just before Sethi's time on the board, more than 1,700 people signed a petition asking Coppell ISD to consider Diwali a professional development or weather day. Right now, Good Friday often gets that designation. The district rejected the change, citing the separation of church and state.
What we did instead is find steps of how we can make it better for Indian.
The district made available the form for requesting Diwali as an excused absence, and they started having conversations with teachers.
Manage the schedule in a way that students, if possible, get more free time around those days.
Right now, Sethi's family also adjusts their celebrations, mostly having them in the evenings. But others worry that by making those adjustments, they're losing something important.
Celebrating a holiday on the day of and fully immersing yourself in it, there's the joy of that is like no other. I truly believe that makes that student have that pride in his culture as well.
Though it wasn't something Brahmachari Hadi really had himself growing up in DFW, he became more spiritual in college. He traveled to India and now serves as a monk in training at the local Chinmaya Mission. It's a Hindu organization, one of several religious or cultural groups UT lecturer Aarti Palodia says has grown over the past few decades as the Asian American population in Texas has gotten bigger, but also more diverse.
A lot of times, with the third generation, or sometimes even the second generation, we're looking at multiracial Indian Americans, where, you know, one parent is Indian, the other one's not. And so when it comes to kind of maintaining one's identity or passing on culture to children, there's a lot of diversity.
Chinmaya Mission was a top supporter of the Diwali petition in Coppell ISD and others just like it in Frisco, Plano, Louisville, Southlake, and Allen. All have significant Asian American populations, all denied to announce a calendar change. But Coppell ISD board member Monish Sethi says the case isn't fully closed. There's opportunity if enough families decide to take it.
It really came down to why are some other of the holidays considered as a floating holiday? And the reason comes down to all financial, because we get funding based on number of hours students attend our school system. And if 50% of the students are not there, why is the school open?
But in past years, Diwali actually had higher attendance than the days around it. Sethi says he'll continue to send his kids.
If I personally have to ask my kids to take a day off from school for Diwali, I personally won't do it.
With the COVID-19 pandemic and the main day of Diwali falling on a Saturday for the next few years, this issue might fall back into the shadows. But that's temporary. In the long run, Brahmachari Hadi says these cultural negotiations are far from over, and the petitions didn't actually fail.
Because when my parents and others moved here 30, 35 years ago, if they were told that, you know, in 30 years, there will be a discussion where people will consider in the school districts whether to have Diwali as a holiday, they would say, how is that even possible?
He says the fact that we are having these conversations is a testament to the vibrancy of the Hindu culture and the openness of Texans to see how it adds to the overall cultural landscape. I'm Laura Rice for the Texas Standard.
This is a special edition of the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. You've heard all throughout the show that Asian Americans are the fastest growing demographic in Texas. While their numbers are small compared to Blacks and Latinos, the state now has the third highest Asian population in the nation, with around 1.5 million people. Traditionally, Asian Americans have had some of the lowest unemployment numbers in the country, but that's changed dramatically since the coronavirus entered the United States. Asian Americans' unemployment claims have risen sharply, and they have experienced far greater discrimination because the coronavirus was first detected in China. We're going to go deeper into all that with three guests. Joining me now are three researchers from Harvard University's AAPI COVID-19 project. AAPI, of course, stands for Asian American Pacific Islander. Vivian Shaw is lead researcher, co-principal investigator, and she's postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Sociology at Harvard University. Vivian, welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for having us.
And we also have Amy Shang, a PhD student in sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. Amy, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
And we have Kara Takasaki, a PhD candidate in sociology, also at UT Austin. Kara, welcome.
Happy to be here.
I don't know which of you wants to start, but how has the COVID pandemic revealed inequities in access to healthcare? Let's start there.
Yeah, so we've done a number of interviews of AAPI who are working in the healthcare industry. So one of the interviews I conducted was with a healthcare worker who is a nurse, and she's a midwife in Chinatown in New York City. And something that she points out is that when we think about Asian American and Pacific Islanders, oftentimes the image we have is of, you know, high socioeconomic class, but there's a wide diversity within that range. And so many of her patients in this Chinatown clinic actually are undocumented individuals. Something I just want to share also is that when we think about the workers, they're not only dealing with having to negotiate their own safety, but some of them are kind of dealing with very dramatic situations. And so one person I spoke to, a young person in his 20s, recently graduated college, had started at a very actually highly resourced research hospital in Massachusetts. And then basically in about March or so of this year, he was in his terms voluntold that he had been redeployed from his work as a research assistant to then work in ICU. I asked him, what are some emotions that surprised you about this experience? And he felt lonely, you know, on his way to work, commuting, and people harassing him and kind of calling him names and directing anti-Asian racism in his direction as he was going off to be a frontline worker.
Thank you for all of that, Vivian. You are right. You touched on several points. I want to ask about the historical framework of racism and now the racism that has been exaggerated by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, this is Amy. I think we're seeing, like, since the first cases were detected in Wuhan, thousands of AAPIs have reported experiencing, you know, more scrutiny, racism, in some cases even violence. There's one national reporting center, Stop AAPI Hate. They've received over 2,500 incidents of discrimination against AAPIs from March 19th, roughly, to the beginning of August. And what we're hearing from both anecdotal accounts and from news reports suggests that, you know, Chinatowns and other businesses that are located in these Asian ethnic enclaves have experienced a direct loss of business, which might potentially persist after, you know, social distancing orders are lifted.
Yeah. So this is Kara. In terms of like job prospects in 2017, about the rates in terms of callbacks for Asian names are very similar to what they do when they do studies with African-American names. When Asians whitened their names, essentially they got double the rate of callbacks. One of the people in that article was saying how she was told that they've hired too many foreign nationals, but she's, of course, Asian American. She wasn't a foreign national. They just assumed because her name. That was before COVID. So now that's probably going to be heightened, right? And so there's a number of these intersectional issues that come up, particularly for Asian Americans, that wouldn't necessarily be true for other groups.
We called the show Overlooked No More. You know, the Asian American population, yes, we talk about the fast growing population, but we also realize that there is sort of that ignoring of the community, as you were saying, when it's not even included in the language for politicians or for budgets or for programs. What do you think about that particular idea of Overlooked No More, especially in Texas?
I think this is a really interesting question. My dissertation research, I'm interviewing Asian American men in professional occupations, broadly defined Asian American men, right? What's interesting is this idea that you wouldn't even figure out that the reason that Asian Americans aren't getting the services that they need, you wouldn't even know that unless there was a seat at the table, right? Even in terms of like when I'm doing my dissertation research and there are like interviews with these men who are high achieving even for their group, there's no network of like mentoring, right, of advocacy. They don't even know that that's something they need. They came from families who never had to deal with that sort of social skill, cultural adaptation, because they came from Asia. And so all of these sort of second generation men come in very highly educated, but not equipped with like just the naturally learned ways of like
cultural,
you know, playing baseball,
America, yeah,
football, beer, like, you know, dating, things that would normally sort of create trust in professional occupations, just sort of naturally happening, like doesn't happen for them. And they don't even know that they're missing it.
Yeah. So this is Vivian. What I would say is that when we talk about Asian American Pacific Islanders, we have often overlooked Pacific Islanders within this COVID pandemic. This is a group that has been really significantly hit. For instance, in Arkansas, most of Pacific Islander or Marshallese in this area are working within essential industries. And so the numbers are that even though Marshallese make up only 3% of the population in Northwest Arkansas, they make up over half of the deaths, right? So not only half of the cases, half of the deaths.
Wow.
And so that is really kind of why we're very motivated to think through the differences within this community and the diversity of that and trying to tell a story that way.
I think it was the Marshall Project that recently analyzed CDC data on excess deaths by race in each state. But specifically because of COVID in Texas, 723 more Asian Americans have died compared to usual, which is a 35% increase over the prior five-year average. And speaking further to these points we've already talked about the need to disaggregate, you know, just because you say 723 Asian Americans, it doesn't tell us anything about the within-group diversity. Each death has obviously a ripple effect in the family, so there are clearly very large communities that are being impacted by all of this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Kara?
And then, yeah, so my last thing would be these Asian stories are important because, like, for me, like, I'm a type 1 diabetic, so I'm at a much higher risk of death and hospitalization because of type 1 diabetes. And sometimes I think with that model minority stereotype of just assuming that Asians are okay and well off, I think we don't also see them as human, as like having just as many sort of intersectional experiences or disabilities or, you know. And so I think that's what's important, is that these stories that we're finding really, they're important because they humanize Asians beyond a stereotype, right?
We've been speaking with Vivian Shaw, Kara Takasaki, and Amy Sheng, all researchers working with Harvard's AAPI COVID-19 project, examining how the pandemic has affected the Asian American and Pacific Islander communities. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is it for today. Happy Labor Day. And on behalf of the entire Texas Standard team and our host, David Brown, thank you for tuning in. Join us again tomorrow. I'm Joy Diaz.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.